Hello, I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides, and this is Talking to Grandma. In today's episode, we talked with Errol De Jesus from Morenita Mami about her commitment to raising an autistic son multilingual. This was our first time chatting with Errol, and wow, we could have talked for hours. She also believes in encouraging language learning that embraces conversations on race and even Black girls' hair. She speaks Japanese, Spanish, and SEO, also currently learning some German. In her spare time, she enjoys writing and spending time with her son. She has published an ebook called Melon Intro to Languages, which opens a discourse on language learning from the Black perspective. It offers practical advice on learning languages, either as an individual or with family. She also has a blog, Mother Tongue, and she spoke at Women in Language in March of 2022. We are so honored to have her on the podcast. This is an amazing conversation that you won't want to miss.
Hello, I'm Rebecca, editor and producer of Talking to Grandma. One more thing before we get started. We ran into some technical issues during this interview, so you might hear me jump in and ask a few questions as well.
Welcome, Errol.
I'm happy to be here.
So let's get started just with the question around learning about your journey to the work. How did you become interested and passionate about language learning and the intersections with social justice?
I would say it started when I was growing up in Houston. Houston has a very large Latino population. And in school, I grew up around a lot of bilingual individuals. And I remember being very envious of them because I thought, well, that's amazing to be able to speak two different languages. Houston also has a really large Vietnamese population because all the signs are always in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese. And again, just being blown away by this idea that someone could understand, a child the same age as me could understand more than one language. And it made me question, why don't I speak more than one language? Why don't I, go back and forth between languages with my friends? And it really gave me this curiosity about difference and about bridging gaps between difference. But I don't want to discredit my twin sister. I have a twin sister who was probably just as curious as I was, if not more. And also credit to my mom, who happened to have different books in her home about studying languages. My sister came across one of those books for Japanese. She said she wanted to study it. And I said, let's study it together because we're twins. We'll have our own secret twin language. And that was many years ago. We were in, I think, the fifth grade. We started studying together. And then everyone's like, Japanese, come on, you'll never use that. Study Spanish. You know, that's way more practical. Look around you, which in hindsight, yeah, made sense because to speak Japanese, you'd have to really use it. It'd be nice to go to Japan or go to a place where there are a lot of Japanese speaking people. So for like middle school up until high school, when I could take Japanese, it was a pretty, well, I don't want to say it was an isolated language experience because I used the internet a lot. I used Rosetta Stone. But when I started studying Japanese, I realized it was mostly textbook, you know, exercises in the class. And I was very close with my teacher. She became a really great mentor. We still talk. We've known each other for years. And I felt that the relationship that I had with her, I remember thinking, I'd love to have this relationship with another native speaker, ideally closer to my age. and to actually have an actual friend from Japan. And there were exchange students that would visit for like a week or two and then be gone, which was really unfortunate. But a part of me really wanted to have that closer experience. And, you know, it was difficult to try to find that online because people just kind of come and go. You talk once and then they just kind of remain in your contacts forever and you never talk to them on Skype. That happened all the time. And it was just an incredible search for like the BFF from another country that just, you know, kind of was overshadowed by trying to get good grades, trying to get into a good college. So I never really questioned having conversation about race, about my hair, about anything, because it was never in the curriculum. It was never a priority. And I never felt close enough with, and my Japanese teacher, she spoke English. So when we would talk about race, it would mostly be in English, because that was just the language I felt most comfortable talking about race in. Well, comfortable is an overstatement. And so I was like, how do you even begin to talk about race in another language, let alone, you know, my native language? And I didn't really learn how to talk about race in more, I don't want to say insightful, but I really didn't have a grasp on how to talk about race. I feel like it was until my senior year in college. And by then I'd been to Japan twice. Again, conversations about race, hair never really came up. Everyone's like happy, polite. Oh, it's great. You're studying Japanese. Come live in Japan someday. All of that. It's all sunshine and rainbows. Something didn't really feel right. I remember I was in Japan and I remember thinking to myself, it's so wonderful to be in a place where you don't hear about someone getting murdered by the cops in the news. Well, a black man getting murdered or a black child. You can be out late at night and playing Pokemon Go and no one will blink twice at you or anything. It's like, oh, wow, what a haven. And I remember turning on the TV in the dorms and there's a news story about a man that gets gunned down, black man that gets gunned down by police in Texas. And it's translated everything. And I'm like, okay, so these conversations are possible in another language. These narratives are global. Like, it's reached different parts of the world. Like, this is just a news segment for now. It's, you know, it's going to be on the screen for a couple of minutes, a couple of seconds, and then it's going to be gone. But I saw that and I couldn't help but wonder, why have I not had more discussions about this in Japanese? So then I come back to the States to start my senior year in college and I started going to therapy, which is like, oh my goodness. I didn't know how much I needed that. I've been suffering from depression for a really long time and I didn't even know it was depression. I thought it was just, I don't feel like going to school today, mom, or I'm not really up for it. And, you know, people always telling me, smile, you'll feel better. You can smile and have depression. like you can be happy and have depression too. It's just, I didn't have that lens. So I took a class called Race and Racism in the United States, I think was the name of it. Not going to lie, I thought it was going to be a class that a bunch of black students were going to sign up for and a professor was going to be black. And we were just going to sit in the classroom and talk about how much we hated the school. It wasn't that. And I was pleasantly surprised. And also that class changed my life. It changed how I talk about race, period, how I think about race. The entire time I was there, I was just like, why didn't I take a class like this sooner? I feel so robbed of knowledge and wisdom that could have made things a lot more, I wouldn't say better, but could have given me a better lens to see things. Because it's one thing when, you know, white students in a class are reading about this and we're learning things at the same time. And for them, it's these are new concepts or maybe concepts they've been familiar with, period. But for me, it's like for every example or concept, I had an experience from my life that I could draw from and bring that those concepts being taught to like a total different level of understanding because there was experience there. And for me, it was absolutely eye-opening. And again, I just couldn't help but wonder, why didn't I get this sooner? Like, I'm so mad. And that was also the time I met my then husband. We were both working in the same restaurant. And I remember he didn't speak. I thought he spoke a little English, but then when we went out on our first date, I realized he don't speak any English. And it was just me, him, and Google Translate for the first couple of dates.
You didn't speak Spanish at that point. Right. It was just Japanese.
Right. It was just Japanese. Yeah, I took Spanish in middle school, but I often got in trouble because I was studying Japanese instead of Spanish. Like I would have the textbook out and then underneath it, I'd be studying Japanese and my teacher would be like, Errol, come on. Really? So I just had random like snippets of Spanish in my brain. And like Spanish I'd heard from my friends growing up, but never really made an attempt to actually start speaking it. Kind of was just on the sidelines, like, okay, I know that's Spanish, but I don't really know what you're saying, but okay, great. And then at some point, my boyfriend at the time was like, you know, it would be really cool if you could learn Spanish. Like, that would really help us. And I'm like, I'm finishing school for Japanese, so you can learn English. How about that? And he was like, oh, you know, I'm super busy and, you know, it'd just be really cool. That's all I'm saying. So I was like, fine, I'll learn Spanish. But I could not do the Duolingo, couldn't do textbooks. I was just like, I'm going to try this method of listening to you and your family and your friends and really just trying to soak it in like a sponge, because I'm trying to do a lot at once. And yeah, I don't want to do this the textbook way. I don't want to do this the school way. I want to get, honestly, I felt like I really wanted the immersion experience I never really got to have with Japanese. Because when I studied abroad in Japan, I felt very, what's a positive way to say this, entitled. I was like, I've been studying this language for several years. I shall come here and make plenty of friends and everyone's going to love me. And that did not happen. No, I mean, you know, I don't even look Japanese. So, and I was in Tokyo, which, you know, a lot of people don't expect. People who don't look Japanese to be able to speak Japanese. So people would constantly talk to me in English. And then depression, that hit. And I was like, I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to talk to anybody. And it was such a struggle because I didn't know what was going on in my brain. I didn't know what was happening. I just knew that I felt really bad. And I blamed it all on myself. I was like, well, it's because you're not attractive enough. Your Japanese is trash and no one wants to hang around you. So coming back to the States, meeting my boyfriend and having the opportunity to hang out with him and just learn Spanish off the fly or immerse myself in it seemed pretty attractive to me. I got the nickname La Morena and I was like, ooh, I like this. What's that? What's a Morena? And, you know, I was always hanging out with my boyfriend. It was just, I was into that. I was like, yes, give me this. I want this. This is something I can live and experience. This is more than a textbook. This is an actual immersion experience that I want. And I'm getting it right here in good old Minnesota. And I really threw myself into it. But the actual conversation when it comes to social justice, and I'm really talking about race, because I felt that while I was dating the man who would later become my husband, it really didn't come up as much. Because, you know, one thing that I asked him was, why is your skin almost as dark as mine, but you're not black? He was like, yeah, I'm a Moreno. And I'm like, so is that black? Or like, what is that? And why are you calling me La Morena instead of La Negra? And he was like, you know, the sun can give you a nice tan and all that. And I was like, oh, okay, so are you black? And he's like, no, but there are black Mexicans. I was like, what? It's like, yeah, just how you have African Americans, you have, you know, black people in Latin countries. I'm like, oh my God, yes, of course. Why did I never, like, why did this never really occur to me? It's like, I don't know. But that was the extent of it.
It's funny that, like, I think most people think Spanish would be a lot easier to learn than Japanese. And then just your experience of having been immersed in Japanese conjugation for so long and then, you know, Spanish being more difficult is an interesting perspective. Oh my gosh, Errol, there's so much that you said in there that's just kind of gold. I want to dig into a bit of that some more. First, when you mentioned of like never having thought about Black Latinos or like that being an identity. And I think that that's really kind of a reality of not seeing them reflected in our media or in our curriculum or in our culture. So if you're, you know, looking at curriculum around learning Spanish, are you seeing that reality in that curriculum? Are you seeing it represented in media? And there's just a whole erasure of Black Latinidad. Being the mother now, you're a mother of an Afro-Latino child. Like, how do you see that now in terms of his identity and how you hope he sees himself and how the world sees him?
I think about the term itself, Afro-Latino. And I think about, sometimes I think about the statistics. I try not to boil it down to phenotype, like appearance, because that can sometimes be pretty deceptive. Even being Black, sometimes I wouldn't know someone is Black unless they told me. I'm like, being Black, being Afro-Latino, it's so much more than just the way you look, right? And with him, what my main concern was, I remember having him, because in the hospital room, it was my husband and his family, and all my family's in Texas. So two Black women from a community of moms came to visit me. And I remember this relief that washed over me. I was like, oh my God, Black people. Black people are in the house. Yay. And then they left and my husband's family came back and I'm surrounded by, you know, Mexican food. And they're all speaking Spanish to me. And I just gave birth. So as you can imagine, I'm exhausted. And I just couldn't help but wonder, is my son going to be Black enough? Is that a thing? I'm like, well, my husband is here and he has all his family. So I feel like we've got that part checked. But will he know that he's Black? Will he, like, was he, well, obviously he's not going to grow up the way I did. And then I started to struggle with checking off race and ethnicity on all the forms and the check-ins at the clinics and stuff. And I remember one time someone put down biracial Black and white. And I'm like, excuse me. So as a mom, it's hard to not be very vigilant of like what labels, what identity, how people are identifying him. I worry about his hair. You know, me and his dad clashed. He was like, you've got to wash it every day. I was like, no, you don't. Yeah. Again, like I said, you're just super like on alert about the words being used to describe your child, how people are describing your child, how you're describing your child. It's easier for me to just say, oh yeah, he's mixed. But at the same time, like we talked, mentioned before, thinking about, you know, what kind of questions is he going to ask? I don't know. He could ask the simplest thing, like, why does mommy look like that? Why does dad look like that?
So kind of going into your son's heritage language, and how did you come to the idea, you know, that you wanted him to carry on and preserve that heritage language that you were just learning?
Right. I don't think there was one specific moment. I think there was always a thought in my mind, especially in my heart, that I know I wanted him to grow up bilingual and having part of, well, trilingual. I remember thinking, I want to speak Japanese to him too. I want to give him all the languages if possible, but Spanish especially, because well, A, you know, his father speaks it, and B, I just feel that from my perspective as a kid, I always wondered, why didn't my mom raised me to speak more than one language? Because I remember she's always going off about, oh, it's such a blessing to speak more than one language. Like, okay. It's just kind of this idea of having transforming generations and not having to settle with, okay, this is how it's always been. It's never going to change. And just being that person that's like, well, no, things can actually be different. I have the power to make a change and hopefully see that change blossom in future generations. There was a moment when I knew that I needed to educate myself on words that I want to be able to use with my son. When George Floyd was murdered on Lake Street, where me and my husband used to go visit all the time to the panaderias and Mercado Central, and it was just like, it was a nightmare to see that. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, where is this happening? And then I remember I see a bus stop in the background. I was like, oh my God, I know that bus stop. I've been at that bus stop before. This is happening here, right here, where we live in our home. And I remember how heartbreaking it was. My then husband was going on Facebook Live and seeing the destruction of the businesses we would frequent. And I remember him asking, how could they do this? And I remember responding, yeah, how could police murder an innocent Black man? I remember my then husband responded, no, how could Black people do this to Latino businesses? And then I said, let's sit down, because we don't even seem to be on the same page, let alone doesn't even seem like we're reading the same book here. And it was you know, by then I had been speaking Spanish for about like 3 years. Yeah, I don't conjugate perfectly. And sometimes I don't use I forget the name of the form. Like sometimes I say cuando sabes instead of cuando sepas. I don't use that form that well, but I can communicate, right? We've gotten as far, we're married with a little one. And, you know, we sit down, I'm just like, hey, I need to talk to you about some pretty important things. And I hope you're open to the conversation. And if I'm being completely honest, he wasn't open to the conversation. And I told myself, well, okay, it's because I don't have the right arsenal of vocabulary. So I'm going to put a pin in it and we're going to come back and we're going to do this right. And then that's when I started writing my ebook. And he helped me with it as best as he could with the Spanish chapter. But, you know, I was writing sentences, example sentences like Black Lives Matter. I was writing Black bodies are more important than physical property. And I remember he was like shaking his head as he was translating some of the sentences for me, like, I don't really agree. And I was like, oh my God, we're married. I was like, how did I miss this? I think I was really jumping into this relationship with rose colored glasses. And I didn't anticipate this being an issue later down the road. So, you know, as months went by, time went on, and it just got increasingly difficult to try to reason with him. I remember he was saying, you know, our son is too young. We shouldn't be thinking about this. This is depressing. This is, you know, I don't want to talk about this. And it just, I, you know, turned to a lot of online communities. I was like, can you help me? This is getting really like, you know, I feel like this is super important. I think about how race was talked about, you know, to me when I was a kid. And, you know, sometimes people would, Black people in schools and the neighborhoods would just tell me things like, you know, white people aren't going to like you, Errol. Things are always going to be harder for you because of the color of your skin. You know, to tell that to like a 6-year-old is kind of, you know, it's like, how are these conversations avoidable? Or is this inevitable? Is there a better way to frame this with my child, given like the education that I have? And like, is there a different way to go about this? And I feel like from my then husband's perspective, maybe it was a mix of both color blindness, ignorance, denial. And in his case specifically, I definitely believe it was an idea of survival. Like if I'm okay by the end of the day, nothing else really matters. Nothing else needs to be discussed. So it was a really exhausting, defeating effort to try and have these conversations. Because again, when something goes wrong, I think I won't speak for all human beings, but I know for myself, it's easy to look inward and say, oh, I did something wrong. You know, my Spanish wasn't good enough. I didn't use the right words. Maybe I brought it up at the wrong time, but it didn't matter if it was at night, in the morning, in the afternoon, at the grocery store. It was such an uphill struggle. Throughout the relationship, I was really excited to do things in Spanish. Like he had medical issues and it was like, well, if the medical interpreter won't show up, I'll do it. And in hindsight, I'm like, Errol, no, you don't even have training as a medical interpreter. Like, why are you putting that pressure on yourself? I just remember at a point feeling so exhausted every day, waking up, everything's in Spanish. If I'm crying, I have to explain myself in Spanish. If I need something, if I need to go to the store or do something. And I just started wondering, why am I putting up with this? Why am I doing this? And then I remember, oh yeah, because I'm posting about my multilingual, multicultural family on Instagram. Gotta look good for the gram. Gotta look good for Facebook. I gotta let everybody know I'm happy. I'm loving my life. I'm like fully immersed, everybody. I have a baby and I love my husband and I love my life. But like in actuality, I'm just like, I'm so tired. I am like one mental breakdown away from just destroying everything. Not my baby, of course, but I was just like, I'm so tired. I don't know. And I kept thinking, well, once I get a job, things will be better. Once we get help for Chris, my son, things will get better. All this like destinational happiness. And I never really thought to look inward in a way that was like challenging myself to identify what are some possible stressors. Later on, I did get a job. It was I called it my dream job. Now it's a good job. Not my dream job, but at the time, I didn't think I could get a job in copywriting because I'd only been doing it for, I've been doing it longer. It depends on how you define copywriting. But to me, it's, you know, when you write the words that go on a website or an email, a social post, and I just always enjoyed doing that. And I felt that writing really saved my life. And even when I was working at jobs I didn't care for, I made time to go to like meetups for people who like writing and blogging. That also led me to starting my blog. I wanted to have a space where I felt like, you know, I know I'm not the only Black mom out there raising a multilingual, multicultural family. And I want to connect with those moms. And so when I started Juanita Mami.
How important was that community to you when you were going through all of these challenges?
That community was absolutely instrumental. Because I started Juanita Mami back in 2019. So my son was about a year old. And I didn't start working on my ebook until 2020. So it was about like a year and a half, no, about a year of just connecting with so many different moms, Black moms from all over the world, Latina moms too. It was just, yeah, when I announced I was working on an ebook, I got so much support. Well, you know, like support for me, metrics wise, is like 40 comments, which is like, oh my God, that's a lot of comments. And people were like, you know, go for it. Great job. And I had joined another group. It's called Black Girls Learn Languages, run by Shahida or Language Bay. She's based in Germany. She's also a sister. And she is just, I mean, we talk yesterday. We talk all the time. I am so happy I met her. She is just a jewel. And she helped, she started the Sisters Only Language Summit. I think their first one was in 2020 during the pandemic. And then they've had like two more after that, where just Black women get together and talk about how much they love languages and travel. And it's just like, my community, my people, oh my gosh. And it's just, it's always invigorating to just be surrounded by Black women like that. And it just really widens your perspective. And it just reminds you that there's so much out there. And when I separated from my husband, I leaned on that community. And then I also found community through my new job. This was very new for me. I started this job and people were actually listening to me and asking about my, my opinion and how I was doing. And I couldn't hold back about what I was going through. I was like, hey, y'all, I'm like a newly single mom, I'm a special needs child. I'm trying to navigate all of this. I'm going to need some time off work, you know, appointments, evaluations. They get scheduled out like months ahead. And it was community that really helped me just stay afloat when I felt like so many things were just out of my control. And so the idea of being abandoned by someone who I'd learned a language for, you know, been doing the most, trying to do everything in Spanish for the past 4 years. The idea of that, like falling through, was just incredibly painful. But I later went on to realize how liberating it was at the same time, because then I really had to start asking myself, well, who is Errol? And what does Errol want to do? And I was like, I'm being honest with you, I want to stop speaking Spanish. I'm like, I want to take like a mini break. And I just like kind of want to just be me for a little bit. And it's like it's not that learning languages isn't a part of my identity, but I felt like it was all of my identity, that I couldn't see myself beyond speaking Spanish or studying Japanese or showcasing my trilingual baby to people. And now coping with his diagnosis of autism and speech delay. I was like, oh my God, that's like, that means what? He can't speak? What's going on? I was like, it's all my fault. I did something wrong. And it took time for me to kind of work through the denial. I was in major denial because I was like, and some of my family and friends were like, did you go to a Black doctor? You know, they try to put labels on the Black kids so early. And I'm like, stop. I just want my baby to be all right. And he was speaking in a sense of echolalia. So that's when you're like repeating after, and children do that. But in Chris's case, the developmental delay means that he's doing echolalia to the point where he's not expressing himself. So, or greeting people or having a back and forth. And that's where speech therapy and occupational therapy come in to kind of help him, you know, regulate his emotions, to start doing daily tasks for himself. So I was like in 1000% survival mode. I wasn't even thinking about using Spanish. And I definitely knew that like my depression was hitting really hard when I couldn't even study Japanese. Well, not even like studying it, but just like speaking it or trying to use it. I just remember part of me like shutting down, like, well, like, no, this is not working. This isn't working. And I was just like, what do I do? Do I take like an adult gap year from languages? Like, how do you navigate this? I'm like, I'm supposed to be like the expert on this stuff. I've self-published an ebook, dang it. I should know what to do. I'm okay with not having encyclopedic knowledge of Spanish right now, because why would I need to put that pressure on myself? I'm still learning a ton of these words in English, and it's still new for my echolalia. What's that? Speech delay. What's that? Like, this is a big learning process for me. And I realized for years I had been like layering, you know, that stress in both English and Spanish. And I was just like, you know, I got a job now. I'm a working mom. I don't want to do this. I don't want to put that pressure on myself anymore.
Just that, like, after the divorce, you said that you wanted to just take a break from Spanish, and how that was just what you needed in that moment. And how it was tied up with all of these expectations and like identity and all of the stuff around raising a trilingual child. And I just wanted to dig into that a little bit more, because raising a child multilingual, like, sometimes we have a vision of what it looks like, that it has to be one way, that it has to be
absolutely
perfect. And really a lot of like parenting in general and multilingual parenting is also like identifying those pressures that you're putting on yourself and making sure that you're not doing that to yourself and then therefore doing it to your kid, right? And that's absolutely a really difficult thing to identify and let go, and know that like multilingualism looks like many things. You started to become multilingual when you were an older child, right? Some children are multilingual starting from birth. Sometimes there's like passive multilingualism. There's different like variations of how much you are fluent in each language. And I think just identifying that there are many different paths, many different experiences, and letting go of that pressure. And so I wanted to hear a little bit more about like what that process was like for you, kind of being the expert in the field on like multilingualism and raising a multilingual child, and then coming to the realization that like that could look different than what you expected. You're raising a multilingual, multicultural son with autism. Like, what was that shift in thinking like for you? What were some of the lessons learned around that?
Well, I remember thinking I should take a page from my own book, literally, because I wrote a whole chapter about multilingual parenting. And I remember thinking to myself, trying to kind of synthesize how I visualized multilingual parenting then, and then how now with this knowledge of autism and speech delay. But yeah, it was trying to kind of just like morph together. Okay, so now I understand a little bit more about autism and his developmental delays. And then I have all these expectations, this kind of like, you know, idea that I've drawn up through experience with, because I've taught language to children before, older kids, tiny kids, probably like around like 4 or something. But it was like all that experience meets this experience. And like, how are you going to put it all together? And reading through it, I was like, well, reading through what I had written, I was like, yeah, a lot of this kind of assumes that your child is going to be neurotypical. And now I'm thinking, okay, so now how are we going to approach this? And I was, to be honest, I was completely terrified into looking to other parents' experiences, because I didn't want to run into some advice that was just going to clash with, because I get a lot of like, don't speak another language to your kid. You're going to cause language confusion. And that's why your kid can't speak now. You know, I was really afraid of that, which is why I wasn't very open about Chris's developmental delays on social media, because I would get unsolicited advice, you know, like, make sure you take him to a black doctor. I'm like, okay. Eventually, when he started speech therapy, I think it was just occupational therapy, and they were basically telling me, like, there's nothing wrong with speaking another language to your child. It's beneficial. And he's more than capable of being able to pick up on that language and tell the difference between them, you know, continue like everything that I realized that everything I had written was still true and I still stand by it. But I think, like you mentioned, it's just like taking a break from a lot of that pressure and the expectations that I had built. Because the way I had fantasized about multilingual parenting, such, I mean, this is before I even had Chris, but just as a little girl growing up, knowing that, okay, when I get older and I have my children, I want to make sure that, you know, we come home and we're switching between different languages. There we were like talking different languages when I dropped them off at school. We're doing this and that. It was just like so much that I had built from very early on. So, and it was addressing those fantasies too, that, you know, made me, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent about my marriage, but that played a really big part into, you know, this fantasy that I had created about what multilingual parenting was going to look like. You know, the husband is going to do this, the wife is going to do that, the community is going to play this role. And now it's like, well, things have shifted. And sometimes the one, you know, part of that puzzle is going to play a bigger role than another part. So I have to ask myself, well, what role do you want to play? You know, what do you want your responsibility to be in this? And, you know, I just remember thinking, I want there to be as little pressure as possible. And that's the thing, even though I mentioned like taking a break from Spanish, the whole beauty of immersion is that you never really take a break. It's always around you. It's always in you in some form or fashion. And you can never really, it's not like you're trying to escape it, but it's just lightening the load, right? So I was scared for a little bit to even like say something in another language to Chris. I was like, okay, we're just going to keep it in English. But then I noticed he was counting in Spanish one day. And I was like, oh, well, he knows how to count. Now I got to talk to him in Spanish. But I was like, well, clearly, you know, he knows that he may not understand that it's another language, but it's somewhere in his memory bank, somewhere in his brain, a part of his brain is like, hey, this is how we're counting in English and this is how we count in Spanish. And he's memorized it and he's using it. He's responding to his nickname, Chancho. And he likes, you know, he's responding to it. So it's like, I don't think it was, and I was telling myself, I don't think it's the right move to be like, let's put it into it. Let's put a stop to it. No more Spanish. I just felt like that wasn't, not like it would be robbing him of something that, you know, it's just like, even though our family is in transition, it doesn't mean that language has to be taken out entirely. It can still play a really important role. And, but at the same time, I reminded myself that just a little pressure. If, you know, if you go a day where you forget to speak Spanish to Chris, then also, like I mentioned before, the beauty of immersion is that sometimes you're using another language and you're not even thinking about it. It just kind of comes to you. And, you know, that definitely happens with me and Chris. But then there's also like unpacking the trauma. And it's really weird to say that sometimes hearing Spanish is traumatizing. Like hearing it, overhearing people speaking Spanish just kind of puts me back into like the pressure that I put on myself during my marriage and kind of like some of those, like, I wouldn't call them bizarre expectations, but like great expectations that ended up, you know, being basically my insecurities in disguise. And I have to take out time to just be like, look, Errol, nobody in this world can own a language. You know, like that's the beauty of languages. So many different people speak them. Great, fun people out there who speak Spanish. So it's like, don't associate the Spanish language with him. Know that you can approach this in a healthy way and fall in love with it all over again and, you know, still have your son be a part of it. And like, that's like my daily mantra. I constantly have to remind myself of it because it doesn't take much to just get overwhelmed, to get triggered, to be like, oh my God, am I doing this right? did I speak enough Spanish today? Did I put on Plim Plim? Did I put on the right stuff on YouTube? What did I do today? And it's just really important for me to remind myself, take it easy. Don't be so serious about this. Language, like, it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be beyond the textbooks and the curriculums. It's supposed to be part of your life.
Yeah, that's such a great reminder. As we wrap up, can you share a little bit about what's bringing you joy, what's keeping you motivated these days?
Well, I will say my community. I still talk to a lot of my gal pals, my Instamigas. another thing that keeps me motivated is my son, period. because I've seen his progress with speech therapy and with, you know, the strategies that they've taught me. And it's not like, I don't know why I always envisioned speech therapy to be like this magic wand, like, yes, we'll just tap your child on the head once and three times and then he'll be able to speak, you know, beautifully and fluently. And I realized that a lot of it has to deal with that bond and connection that he has with people that he trusts. In this way, I kind of translated to not relationships between partners, but a relationship between, you know, a mother and, you know, parent and a child, guardian and a child, because my son has a lot of trust, a lot of affection towards me. So I know that when I am speaking to him, be it in English, Japanese, or Spanish, I know that there's a level of love and trust in those words and security. And it just, it really makes me feel proud to have this blessing, this opportunity to be able to raise a special needs child, you know, to speak different languages. And, you know, I don't see him having autism as a blockage to that. You know, it's just another lens to view the way that he interacts with the world. That's just the way his brain is wired. That's just the way that he's processing and interacting with the world. And I think, you know, same thing with my bouts with depression. It's so easy for us to just be like, oh, wow, this is the label you have. And this is kind of what's defining you now. And you have this issue. And oh, my God. But it's like, no, this is just the way that my brain is. And this is how I'm interacting with the world. And it doesn't have to be a stigma. You know, it can be another, like you said, there's so many different paths to multilingualism and to learning languages, you know, and the same goes for how we live our lives. And there's so many different paths to fulfillment as individuals.
Errol, it's been so great to have you join us today. Can you tell people where they can find you?
I'm still kind of active on Instagram. I mean, I look at a lot of re-uploaded TikToks on there. So, I mean, don't hesitate to shoot me a message or like some of my old posts. I promise to like your post back. But I do still blog when I find the time. But I do still blog on Modernita Mommy. My blog is, like you mentioned, Mother Tongue. And I recently put a post on there about raising a child multilingual, a special needs child multilingual, and, you know, what that has taught me. So if you're interested in my writing and my ramblings about multilingual motherhood, please check out my blog. My website itself, there's a lot of creative, like, copywriting stuff on there. I don't know who's into advertising, but you're free to check that out too. Advertising is really fun and we could definitely use more diversity in that field. But yeah, I really do enjoy finding other Instagram accounts that are about, especially like parents raising their kids, speaking different languages. It is just such an amazing journey, and it's beautiful to see the different journeys out there.
Wow, like, what a powerful story and narrative and journey that you're on. And I know that it's going to provide so much like inspiration and community for people that are listening in. That was the hope of this podcast, is to like make this feel less of an isolating journey. And I think that there's just so much knowledge and wisdom and what you shared with us today. So thank you for being so open. Thank you for sharing so generously. And thank you for doing the work that you're doing. And thank you for speaking with us while momming at the same time.
Talking to Grandma is owned by the Language Preservation Project and sponsored by Onward. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara. And I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. We love hearing from you. Email us at hello@thelanguageproject.co, slide into our DMs on Instagram at @talkingtograndma, and remember, please subscribe or follow us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening right now. Help us grow our community and reach more families and educators by sharing this podcast or leaving a review. See you next episode.